Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Gavin Edwards has made a successful career writing about pop culture and the people who create it, from musicians to actors. He's a longtime contributor to Rolling Stone. He's written 11 New York Times bestsellers. What may be his latest bestseller is his new book, The World According to Tom Hanks. It focuses on one of America's most beloved Hollywood icons, so that's bound to generate some reader interest. But Gavin Edwards is himself an interesting character. I mean, what other best-selling author do you know that has been a demolition derby driver, a game designer, and has appeared on Jeopardy? We spoke to Gavin Edwards earlier this year on the release date of his new book. Charlotte and Gavin Edwards joins us now for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. I call you a charlatan, but you're actually a citizen of the world. I just found out you have dual citizenship.
I do. I was born to British parents in the United States.
Wow.
So up until Brexit, I was actually a citizen of all of Europe, but that's going away.
And you've lived in London, you've lived in L.A., you've lived in New York, and now here?
Yes.
Okay, explain it.
Well, that you just want to know the why here part?
Yeah.
My wife came to town to be the curator at the Beckler.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, and her last show, Wrestling the Angel, is still up at the Beckler for the rest of the week, so people can go check that out.
Okay, all right. Well, you went to Yale University, you graduated with a BA in English. A year later, you were both a contributing editor and an associate editor of Details magazine. Writing primarily about music.
Mostly about music. That, you know, sort of 21-year-old kid, and all of a sudden I'm like on the bus with Nirvana touring through Germany.
Yeah, there's a movie about that, isn't there?
He got a lot of things
right. Wasn't that in the Tom Hanks movie? The young writer, or am I thinking?
It was a Cameron Crowe movie. You're thinking of Almost Famous.
Yes, Almost Famous.
And Tom Hanks made his own movie about like being young, which is That Thing You Do.
Yeah.
So you've sort of fused the two, I think.
But That Thing You Do, that's a great song, by the way.
Yes, it is.
Anyway, then you moved on to Rolling Stone to write about pop culture. What is it about pop culture? Was it just that you were young? Because you're still writing about, you're still young, but you're still writing about pop culture. So what is it about pop culture that fascinates you?
Well, I mean, it was something that I think, I'm 16 years old and I'm discovering this thing I care about deeply. You can actually take it seriously.
Of course.
I just loved that there was room to do something. You could be insightful. The things that people deeply connected with, the songs that they were singing all day, you can unveil a little bit piece of it and you're revealing something that means something to people. And, I love serious history. I love literature. And there's a lot of merit in writing about all kinds of art. But that was my crowbar into writing about art, I think.
I'm trying to remember back when I was 16, 17,
yes.
18 years old. But I do remember that music was everything, particularly in the 60s and 70s. Music was everything.
What was the first album you bought with your own money?
I don't know what the first album was. I can tell you what the first single I bought was.
Please.
It's My Party. Leslie Gore.
Produced by Quincy Jones, who later, that was his first big thing, and later went on to do Michael Jackson's Thriller and many other things. But that was like his break into the business as well.
So that was either the first one or the second one. The other one could have been I Will Follow Him, Little Peggy Marks.
Ah!
Okay.
So you like the girl singers.
Yeah, I do like girl singers. that was a long time. I was probably still in middle school when I bought those records. But is the fascination of young people with music today as strong as it was then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people consume music differently, and, there isn't the same thing of, I'm going to buy one album and listen to it over and over because I only have one album.
And then lay on the bed and read the liner notes.
Right. Oh, my gosh. That's the tape engineer. I wonder what, then here's a little cryptic inscription. I once interviewed Ice Cube, the rapper, and he was remembering how when he was a kid, pre-MTV and pre-videos, he would hold up an album cover and move it around to make it like look a little more vivid as he's listening to the music.
Well, how do you do that today? Because everything's a download.
Right. So you don't do that. And it's easy. And, everyone's spoiled for choice. But that doesn't mean that people don't connect deeply with it. And, you know, if like what they care about is, you know, like Mac Miller or Post Malone or whoever it is, like they can really get into it just as much as we ever did. So
how about you? I mean, you started as a young person, a kid, writing about music for high-profile magazines, and you're still writing about pop culture. Do you still consume music the way you do?
Absolutely. Well,
are you hip? Because a friend of mine from college radio said you have to grow with the music or the music without will outgrow you, Sheldon Michelson, and he was absolutely right.
Right.
It's outgrown me.
So I don't necessarily have my thumb on every single thing that comes out the way I did when I was 19 years old or when I was 25 years old and I was editing a record review section. It was my professional responsibility to have an opinion on everything.
Yeah.
And part of the luxury of getting older is that you can like delve into things that you like care about deeply and say, this week I'm just going to listen to this old like Miles Davis box. Like, wow, they released like 8 hours of outtakes from the Jack Johnson sessions. You have the privilege of doing that. But I also love what's happening today. And I love being able to listen to like the new Janelle Monáe record and say, like, she's an amazing talent. Like, she's going to be huge. So I get to pick and choose more from the fire hose of culture that comes out and say, like, well, I'll take a cup here and a cup there. But I love what's going on right now.
You also came up in a time when people who wrote for magazines and had an opinion about movies, about mm-hmm. music, about television, whatever it may be, books, those people were respected. Their opinions were elevated above the rest of us because you brought an expertise to it.
We weren't that respected, but go on. I see where you're going.
People would disagree with you, perhaps.
Yes,
but nonetheless, well, Pauline Kael said, so it must be a great movie or it must be a terrible movie. Today, everybody has a published opinion on everything, and so we've seen critics and reviewers fall by the wayside. What are we missing?
Well, I mean, so what we're gaining is that, you know, the opportunity, it's obviously like democratizing. That if you've got a smart opinion, you can step up and people will pay attention to it. And even if it's just like an incisive, like one sentence thing on Twitter, people can connect to that. And there's a lot of venues and there's a lot of places for people to get that. I think what we're missing is not so much the valorization of individuals that, you know, sort of like people who have strong voices, like my friend Emily Nussbaum writes TV criticism for The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of people certainly like respond to her and link to her and I see what she does. I think what we're missing is the longer argument, that it's not so much who says it, but the fact that everything tends to get boiled down into a sentence or two or three.
Yeah, but, Emily Nussbaum.
Yes.
New Yorker. That has gravitas.
Sure.
But is her opinion considered to be any better, any more valid, any more accurate than your friend on Facebook that you friended with a like and you've probably never met?
I think it is, but not so much because she's the TV critic at The New Yorker and more because what she says, you know, like she has built up a personal reputation and has gravitas and you can read it and you're like, oh, well, this is a smart take on a show that I hadn't thought about. Okay. So that in itself carries weight. Now, should you miss the fact that, you know, like there are people who are we like instinctively look to interpret things for us at any given moment?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking you.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Because I think that I know critics who know what they're talking about.
Right.
Because they've made it their life's work to know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Who've studied things along the way, who have seen every movie or listened to every album in a particular genre, so they really do have a valid opinion based on historical fact and based on the progression of a particular actor's career or a director's career or a musician's career. They have a frame of reference. And they've made it their life's work. It's like I don't go to my next door neighbor if I have a sniffle to diagnose me. I go to the doctor.
So
you're looking at me like I'm crazy.
But no, I'm not looking at you like you're crazy. I want to get. But I guess what I'm saying, I don't disagree with what you're saying about, you know, like sort of expertise is good. I'm disagreeing that it's been completely eliminated. That I think actually, that, you know, sort of The fact there's more voices, but I don't feel like the voices of experts and people who really know what they're talking about have been drowned out.
Okay. But by the way, we're talking to Gavin Edwards, and he's here to talk about Tom Hanks,
who I'm actually an expert on at this point.
Well, we don't want to hear about that. you have written 11 books. I referenced them earlier. Your first, mm-hmm. was a book about lyrics.
Misheard lyrics
called "Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy." In fact, you have written three books. About misheard lyrics.
Yeah.
Are we all deaf, or are people mumbling in these recordings so we can't hear?
People are mumbling. rock music has many virtues, but elocution is not one of them.
Why is that?
Because the passion of the moment in the take, and at a certain point, people aren't so careful about even rhymes, and you have these 45 singles of Little Peggy March or whoever, and you make it your own. And so you sing along loudly, and if you've been singing "There's a Bathroom on the Right" instead of "There's a Bad Moon on the Rise," well, it means more to you that way, apparently.
So "Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy" is clearly a lyric that we got wrong. What is it?
It's Jimi Hendrix, and he was actually singing "Excuse Me While I Kiss the Sky."
Okay.
And whenever there's anything, sort of foreign languages in a song,
right,
will always throw people off, because, the Beatles sing "Sont des mots qui vont très bien ensemble" in "Michelle,"
right,
and people think "Sunday Monkey Won't Play Piano Song." But if you're 12 years old and you don't speak French, then sure, it's the Sunday Monkey.
Okay. The other books that you wrote about misunderstood lyrics are called "Deck the Halls with Buddy Holly." Oh, please, really? "When a Man Loves a Walnut." Really?
Yeah.
He's got the whole world in his pants.
Now, I should say, these are not all things that I personally misheard. But I got hundreds and hundreds. This is in the era I wrote it. It was pre-email. I had a large cardboard box of just all the mail I got from people saying, "At last, I can confess my secret shame. Here's this."
Well, who really would hear "Deck the Halls with Boughs of Holly" as Buddy Holly?
How many eggnogs have people had when they come up to your front doorstep and start singing?
Did it surprise you that so many people misunderstood so many enough lyrics that you could get four books out of
it? Yes. I knew it was a thing, and I knew that I had a clutch of them to start off with. And then when I first started doing it, I just would say to people, "Do you have a misheard lyric?" The first book was largely me just sort of buttonholing people at parties and saying, "I know you misheard something at some point."
Right.
And people, "I don't want to talk about this, the Games Without Frontiers, Je Sans Frontier, I always thought, she's so funkier." And I'm like, "All right, we've got something."
So if this is pre-email.
Yes.
That means it was during the era of liner notes, where
yes,
they printed the lyrics.
Yes! People could have looked it up at any moment, and yet they didn't.
Clearly we are lazy.
The surprising thing I learned about it, by the way, is that so many of the misheard lyrics, about sort of sex and romance, sure, that's expected, so many of them were about food.
Really?
Yeah, and I fear it's just the hierarchy of needs, that the things that you deeply care about turn out to be sex and food.
You mean we thought they were singing about sex and food and they weren't? Or
they're often singing about sex, but they were rarely singing about food, and many people would misinterpret it, that it was about food.
Food.
Yeah.
Okay. Gavin Edwards is our guest. He's a writer, author. He's written many books, among which is his latest, which I think comes out today, "The World According to Tom Hanks, The Life, The Obsessions, The Good Deeds of America's Most Decent Guy." And we will actually talk about this, I promise, as we go through the hour. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlatine Gavin Edwards is our guest. I spoke to him earlier this year on the release date of his latest book, "The World According to Tom Hanks, The Life, Obsessions, The Good Deeds of America's Most Decent Guy." So, you've also published a book entitled The Beautiful Book of Exquisite Corpses.
Yes.
A Creative Game of Limitless Possibilities. It is not about corpses. It is about a style of art.
Yes.
From what, the 1920s France?
Yes.
That you discovered? How did you discover it?
I discovered it when I took a surrealism class in college many years ago. And it's... this is where we have to paint the picture on radio. But if you have a piece of paper and you fold it in three, and somebody draws the top third, and then someone not seeing what was on the top draws the middle, and then someone not seeing any of that draws the bottom, and then you unfold it and you've collaborated. And sometimes it's wonderful and delightful, and you sort of tapped into some collective unconscious thing, and sometimes it's just an incoherent mess. But I was thinking, why don't you do this in a book? And so it's a collection of over 100 artists and perforated so you can tear it out. And there's a starter panel. And some of them are from comic artists or tattoo artists, but some of them are from musicians. Like Grace Slick submitted something, or Robbie Krieger of The Doors. And so you do it, and you and a friend finish this, and you discover I've been collaborating with a member of The Doors.
Oh, my gosh. We have a Grace Slick doodle over there. She likes to draw rabbits. Nice rabbits.
She drew a beautiful profile of a woman for this.
Really?
She actually,
So was this a parlor game in 1920s France?
Sure. André Breton invented it, sort of like with a bottle of wine, invites a couple of friends over. And he was big on just sort of like making up surrealist games, because it was all about like tapping into the unconscious. Mm-hmm. That like this is the pure thing. Like things like automatic writing. If you just sort of like type and you don't think about it, and you tap it, like it'll all come out, and then like the genius will be there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're like, there's flickers of genius. You actually need to edit it. But
folding the thing in three reminds me of Mad Magazine.
Yeah, Al Jaffe fold-ins. Yes.
Although he had a method to his madness. This doesn't seem to have any method to it. And you used some local Charlotte artists.
Yes, many. Many people connected with the Goodyear Arts Center, and people like Dustin Harbin and Holly Keough and D'Angelo Dia. And Jeff Jackson, who has a book out now. And so it was nice that, there's sort of like pockets of creators I knew from different places, and one of them was tapping into the artistic talent of the city.
So that's what I've noticed about some of your books, not all of them, that it's not really a book in a traditional sense that you would sit down and read cover to cover. It's kind of a creative thing.
Yes, some of them. I mean, the Misheard Lyrics, like that was also a collaborative thing that, sort of in that case, it was like people sending me mail and me curating and presenting it. And this one was just like delightful because, I don't have that much drawing talent myself. But I love that it sparked that, and asking people and giving them almost like completely free rein, saying just like, hey, here's your panel. Here's the dimensions. Just make something amazing.
Do you have one of your works of art in the book?
I have. So there's also about 20 sentences because you can do it where you tell a story with like one panel at a time, not knowing any further than the sentence that came before.
Right.
And so I contributed a sentence.
So I have read about your books. The only book I've seen in the flesh is the Tom Hanks book.
Yes.
But just looking at the Tom Hanks book and reading about some of your other books, you seem to have an out-of-the-box approach to writing.
Well, thank you.
Is that something that's easy? Well, of course, you have a track record as being a writer for some highly regarded magazines, but did that make it easier, more difficult to get a publisher to publish?
Well, it's more I try to serve the material. The Misheard Lyrics, like there had never been a book quite like that before. But I said, like, what are you going to do with this like pile of lyrics, and how do you do it? Tom Hanks, the book I did 2 years ago was called The Tao of Bill Murray. And you hear these crazy stories about like sort of Bill Murray shows up at your party, washes the dishes and leaves, yeah. Or he steals a golf cart at 3 a.m. in Stockholm, or he walks up to you, puts his hands over your eyes, and then when you see who it is, says, no one will ever believe you, and walks away. So I had all these stories, and I knew I wanted to do a book about that. not about, you know, sort of like, and then in 1982, Bill Murray made this movie. And so I said, how do you best serve it? And in that case, it was, you know, sort of like collecting as many of the stories as I could and tracking down people who had never told them before about like, oh, I was playing piano in this like hotel in Rhode Island. And, you know, like Bill walked up and ended up like singing with me till like 3 a.m. And so it said, realizing he's not just, you know, sort of doing this to be wacky. He's actually got a philosophy of life that he's manifesting.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. Is he doing, because he does very strange things. He photobombs people's weddings.
Yes.
He'll show up at, I guess he'll be in the neighborhood. He'll know there's parties going on at somebody's house. And he'll just walk in.
Yeah.
And or become a bartender in a bar. Just, I'm here, I'll tend bar. And so people don't expect that from a Hollywood star or comedian. Is that to keep his name alive? Is it a function of his brand of comedy? What is that?
It is neither of those things. It is because, I mean, I think the big secret thing is, you know, he's secretly teaching us how to live. That he doesn't say, you know, sort of do this, but I think that's the implicit lesson. But the immediate, like, moment-to-moment thing is he sees people, and the way he puts it is like, you know, sort of people are sort of stuck in a rut that you're just like, you're doing your thing the way you do every day. And he just wants to wake people up. And he says that I hope people would do that for me when I'm in that rut. And so he's giving them a spark. And when he does that, it gives himself a spark. It's sort of like he has the jolt of I'm out, I'm having a moment. Yeah. Like we're sort of like making something special that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
And he's done a lot of films, but not that many films. I'm wondering how he makes money if he's going to give it away like that. Seriously.
Bill has not heard me.
did he talk to you for the book?
Yeah, he did.
Really? What's he like?
He's very generous of spirit, but on his own terms. That, you know, sort of like he's taller than you think, and he's got a lot of presence, and, you know, he can sort of like make the room come alive. But he can also, the people who work with him say this all the time, that, you know, just sort of like, you know, you're making a movie with Bill Murray, he might show up like an hour and a half late and he'll throw out the script when he gets there. And it's infuriating to everyone who's working with him. But it's also, you have something magical that wouldn't have been there before. It's worth it.
Wow. The book that you wrote about him and this latest book, The Tom Hanks, The World According to Tom Hanks, you've described as sideways biography.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, in each case, it's, as I'm saying, not wanting to do the blow-by-blow of he moved to this city and he did this thing, like a traditional biographical approach, which I think with some people is rewarding. With other people, you feel like you know the rhythm of that and you don't get as much out of it as you might. And in with both Bill Murray and Tom Hanks, they're people who have a coherent philosophy of life.
Okay.
And so what I want to write about is how that philosophy manifests itself in the world and how they are like the people who they are, and like sort of taking that from, in the case of like Tom, Bill, all the crazy things he does. In the case of Tom, like his passions and the things that he cares about deeply. And I think you learn more about them than you would if it was just, you know, sort of like a chapter after chapter.
You also wrote a book about River Phoenix.
It's called
Last Night at the Viper Room, River Phoenix and the Hollywood He Left Behind. Why the title?
Well, he died at the Viper Room.
Okay.
And the, you know, and he died very young. He was 23. And that was a, also, that was more of a traditional biography, but I wanted to take in also more of a social picture of what was going on in Hollywood at that time. And the thing that like unlocked the book for me there was discovering that the night he died at the Viper Room, not only was he there, but there was a member of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, there was Johnny Depp, there was the TV actress Christina Applegate, there was a member of Tom Petty's band, there was Gibby, the rock musician. So all these people were in the room and saying, like, okay, how did everyone come into one place? And like, and if you take a step out and say, like, what brought them there, excuse me, then what can you learn about, like, their life and times, in addition to, like, sort of, like, the very sad life of River Phoenix?
There are so many celebrities that you could write a book about. Mm-hmm. How did you choose River Phoenix, Tom Hanks, Bill Murray?
Very different people. I've got to care. Like, if you don't care, then it's going to be a stone in your shoe for a year as you're doing it. And you have to be willing to, like, get inside the head of that person. And in the case of Bill Murray, I want like a big American story. That, you know, sort of like, here's a guy, you know, sort of everybody cares about him and they love these things, but they don't know what's going on behind him. And it was a similar impulse with Tom of like, who is like, do you want to like get in where there's somebody that like, I wanted the, if it's somebody that people deeply connect with, but don't know a lot about,
right,
then you have the chance of really sort of like going into interesting territory that, you know, sort of like, I can find a map that like tells you something about the person and implicitly about the world that we live in. And if you have, like, if you've never been to that territory, maybe you've sort of like, you've looked and you like, you love this person's work, but you know, it can be fascinating to dive in.
Bill Murray, obviously successful in his own way, calls his own shots.
Yes.
Not traditional Hollywood or even traditional television, not even a traditional comedian.
No agent, no manager, no publicist.
Right, and an 800 number.
A 1-800 number, yes.
That he'll maybe return your call if he feels like it.
Yes.
Even if it's an agent or somebody offering him $1 million movie or more several million dollar movie, he may not call you back. Tom Hanks seems to be the polar opposite of him. He's major box office. Has been for years, somehow, and the book goes into this, curated a career and found his way through that career to figure out how to be the Tom Hanks that he is today and actually became a good actor in the process.
Yes. So there's a turning point, and you can actually pinpoint it with Tom Hanks, and it's a league of their own. Because he had spent the 80s making sort of one like assembly line Hollywood romantic comedy after another. And some of them are charming, like I love Splash. Some of them are just goofy and, you know, you can see that he's punching the clock, something like Turner and Hooch. But like it was one after another, like the character he called the guy in a hole, you know, sort of like, oh, you know, sort of like, I want to be in love and I can't get my car to work. And so there's a point where he went into his agent and said, I'm tired of it. I don't want to do this anymore. You know, sort of like, I want to play like adults who are having like adult issues and just like turn down all of these roles and let's find something better.
He's also done a ton. I was astounded. I have a list of all the films that he's done, and I thought, my God, it never stopped. and some of them, I mean, there are years when he made 4 and 5 films, which is impossible. You can't do it. But he did it. And I know in the book you talk about the fact that he has enough self-realization to know at some point that people are going to get tired of me.
Yes. Yeah, that was also something, especially like in the 80s when he was younger. He was making a couple movies a year. And part of that was, you know, like being careerist. Like I, you know, like establish my name, like put money in the bank.
Right.
Part of it was he was in an unhappy first marriage and like, get me out of the house. Like I can go and work. But the analogy he used was like, I could be Palmolive, like a brand that's famous but nobody cares about.
Read the first
sure.
couple of paragraphs of the preface, because this is how you sum him up, I think.
Tom Hanks is a really nice guy. Hey, wait, where are you going? Since Tom Hanks is a really nice guy is the sum total of the knowledge many people have about the actor, let's go deeper, and let's start with nice. It's hardly ever a compliment, except in the hands of grandmothers who put a high value on politeness. It's almost a term of contempt. Nice is what you say about an edible but forgettable meal, or about a blind date whom you won't be seeing again. Modern society, however, values feuds, celebrities who subtweet sassy insults at their exes, and reality show contestants who declare, I didn't come here to make friends.
Later in the book, I think it's the very last line of the book, you say Tom Hanks did come here to make friends. But in a world, at least the nation, in which everything is so highly polarized, where rudeness, meanness, bad manners, bad language are not only tolerated, in the case of the president, they are rewarded.
Yes.
How do you explain the popularity of a guy who's just plain nice?
Well, I mean, I think it's a mistake to say that because these things are rewarded, that they're the central value of the country. One of the things that I discovered doing the book is people are so excited and happy, like, oh, Tom Hanks feels like a corrective. That, you know, there's this like old-fashioned like Jimmy Stewart strain of like square-jawed like American like Norman Rockwell, Fred Rogers decency. Yeah. Feels like that's what we need right now.
He's often compared to Jimmy Stewart, and
yes.
He knows that, and at least your book says that he knows that. And has he tried to distance? I don't know why you would want to distance yourself from that, because Jimmy Stewart was a big star, and he was
right.
A nice. He seemed to be a nice guy. Hard to tell about people of that era, because no one ever wrote honestly about any of them.
Right.
Does he have a problem with being compared to Jimmy Stewart?
You can see it he started getting the comparison all the time. And at first he said, wow, that's very flattering. And after a couple of years of hearing it all the time, you're like Jimmy Stewart. He's like, nothing against Jimmy Stewart, but I'm my own guy. These days you don't get it as much anymore because, he's clearly found his own path.
So he'll be turning down that biopic.
He does plenty of biopics, though. And they're always people that, we sort of hold up as, valorous people like Sully or Fred Rogers.
Right. So the nice guy's finished last phrase doesn't work with him because he's obviously finished on top.
Right.
And it's not finished yet. That's the point. But nice doesn't seem to sell. You mentioned it in the first paragraph of your book. And there's a whole section of the book called The Nice Manifesto.
Yes.
It is part of the secret of Tom Hanks' success, and the reason that so many people are attracted to him outside of his talent, the reason that you can write a book about him and begin it with niceness, is it because that's what we are craving?
I think that's absolutely true. So many people, there's two threads of this. One is that I would talk to his friends, and they'd say, the first thing they'd say is, I don't know how you're going to write about this guy, because they knew that it was that he was just like a solid, decent guy, and so you're not getting the dirt from the time he drove his car into a ditch and stumbled out with three midget hookers or what have you. But the other thing is that now that people are getting the book, they're saying, oh, thank God he turns out to be the person I really wanted him to be.
Right.
Because, we don't know. I guess we know more about Jimmy Stewart than we did when he was alive. But, there's so many people, it can be a facade. The veneer of Hollywood is a strong thing. And
a publicist creation.
Absolutely.
Right.
And we willingly partake in that many times we would rather believe the fantasy. But it is just still life-affirming to find that not only is Tom Hanks' niceness and real and something he does in his day-to-day life and trying to find ways to improve the lives of the people around him, it's something that, hasn't stopped him from becoming the wonderful person that he is.
Life has not been a bed of roses all the way through. So he could have easily turned out to be cynical and unhappy, etc. We'll talk about the life that he's led and where it has led him to in a moment with our guest today, Gavin Edwards, in just a moment at Charlotte Talks.
Your idea could be the next great podcast. WFAE has launched the Queen City Podquest, a contest to find a new story for the next big show. All ideas are welcome. Submit yours by January 27th at wfae.org/Queen City Podquest.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The World According to Tom Hanks is a brand new book by Gavin Edwards, our guest today. The life, the obsessions, the good deeds of America's most decent guy. And I think his movies, in large part, reflect who he is. And Wendy Herkey, he's put together a little montage of all of, not all, but most of Tom Hanks' films. This'll reignite some memories for you.
All my life, I've been waiting for someone, and when I find her, she's a fish.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
You are a toy! You weren't the real Buzz Lightyear. You're an action figure. You are a child's plaything.
Sam, tell me what was so special about your wife.
Well, how long is your program?
Ryan,
I don't know anything about Ryan. I don't care. The man means nothing to me. It's just a name. But if... You know, if going to Rommel and finding him so he can go home, if that earns me the right to get back to my wife, well, then that's my mission.
Mr. Beckett, come in.
It's good to see you again, counselor.
What happened to your face?
I have AIDS.
Oh.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Cactus 1549.
We hit birds.
Cactus 1549, if we can get it for you, do you want to try to land runway 13?
We are unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
Wilson, where are you? Wilson! Wilson!
Well, you coming?
Where?
Why, to the North Pole, of course! This is the Polar Express!
Just, I mean, when you think of it, when you put the titles to those clips like Apollo 13 and Saving Private Ryan and Sully, and I don't know if Captain Phillips was in there or
it
not.
It wasn't.
Da Vinci Code. There's some big, groundbreaking, memorable movies in there, scattered in among the other ones that are not so Mamma Mia, not so memorable, but nonetheless.
No Mamma Mia. What are you thinking of?
What's not right here, Mamma Mia? Here we go again.
I'm sorry. He was a producer, I believe.
Oh, he's a producer.
Yeah,
okay. Well, that's a memorable nonetheless. He's done a lot of great work and some very different work.
And just listening to that, and it was a joy for me because you can see the range of vocal ability he has.
Yeah.
That when he's pitching his voice, you know, like much higher for when he's playing Woody, that you can see he's like using it as an instrument.
Yeah.
And you get so pulled into any individual movie, you don't think about it, but you see them next to each other, like he's mixing it up.
And the clip from the baseball film,
A League of Their Own.
League of Their Own, where he gets to be cantankerous and angry and mean. He's going against type.
Yeah. And that was
why he wanted to do it, right?
It was totally why he wanted to do it. And to put on, like, he put on weight. He's got, like, his neck is bulging over his collar. You know, he's walking with a limp. He took such joy in being a supporting character in a movie where he didn't have to, like, carry it and he could, like, be cranky.
So you wrote this nice book about this nice guy.
Yes.
And he did not cooperate with you.
That's actually not true. He didn't sit down with me, but he was so nice about it, Mike. I can't even begin to tell you. So the way you correspond with Tom Hanks is, or the way I did, which turned out to be successful, is he loves typewriters. So you send him, I sent him a typewritten letter, and I got a typewritten letter back in which he was like, well, maybe I'd have time like a year and a half from now. And so I said, okay. But what he did do was every single person I got in touch with, if they said, I'd be happy to talk to you, but I've got to talk to Tom first, make sure it's okay. He always gave him the green light.
So, and did he know your work?
I had sent him a copy of the Bill Murray book, so I don't know if he had been following my career before that. Right. I assume not, but he had something else to look at so he could say, like, okay, this guy isn't a total hack.
Most important question of this entire conversation.
Yes.
Where did you find the typewriter?
The answer is the South County branch of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Library.
Really?
They have, sort of upstairs in, like, sort of the computer room, there is one electric typewriter.
What kind is it?
I believe it is a Brother brand.
What did he write you back on? Was it an old manual typewriter?
I believe most of his typewriters are electric typewriters, but he's got over 300, so
yeah.
I don't know which one.
Because I saw a story about that once where he showed some reporter all of his typewriters and where he gets them. Perhaps you would have been more successful if you'd sent the typewritten letter with the typewriter.
Somebody did that and actually got him to appear on a podcast.
Really?
Yeah, they called it a typewriterogram. But it had been done.
Yeah. So he was not cooperative, and yet he was cooperative. Your first section is titled A Brief History of Tom, and you start with his early childhood. I knew nothing about him.
Yeah.
Nothing about him.
I knew very little, and I was really amazed to find out just sort of like his childhood was not what I expected.
No, it doesn't sound happy. It does sound itinerant.
I think it was very lonely.
Very lonely. But his parents are divorced and remarried several times. You quote him as saying, "I could entertain myself for days on end without any need of distraction. I pondered Woody Allen-ish kind of stuff. When is the sun going to burn out? How come the world is so neat? Why is James Bond cool?" And these are thoughts of a child.
Yes.
I mean, he's a little boy.
Yeah.
When he's thinking these thoughts, because he's got nobody in the house. He says, describes himself and his brothers as feral wolf boys. Really?
So there's a couple of years. See, they're being raised by their father, but their father is working like 18 hours a day, like running the kitchen in various restaurants. And so they're just kind of doing their own thing. They're like, okay, like we'll like make soup again for dinner and we'll burn it. And that's the way it is. And we've got vegetables, but we're going to throw them out. And you know, like, and we're going to watch TV for 6 hours because we can. And like we'll set off a firecracker in the living room because who's going to stop us?
And once that goes on for several years, I think his father got remarried and brought a Chinese woman into mm-hmm. their lives who was very regimented. And
yes.
They just ignored it because once you open Pandora's box, you can't put those kids back in it.
Right. His older sister actually says, "I'm out." You know, like she leaves home, like goes to live with mom for the first time ever because just like any structure at all was antithetical. And in all this time, you know, like it gets Tom to go places he wouldn't have otherwise. So like he pours himself into school. Like he's not a great student, but he finds like the drama club. And he finds a church, and in both those places, he needed like that community
right,
and
right.
that sense of like you know what he wasn't getting at home.
If he's not talking to you about this, mm-hmm. how did you find out about it?
I talked to people who knew him, and he has talked about it. He's very private in many ways, but if you're a public figure for 40 plus years, that you know sort of it ends up coming out over the years, and so. You know, like you piece it together and you do legwork. I've read basically everything that has ever been written about Tom Hanks in every interview he's ever done. And, you know, I've sort of like just, there's a public record at this point.
His father was not a bad guy. His father was in the restaurant business, and the restaurant business is one of the toughest businesses in the world.
Yeah.
And he would leave the house early in the morning to go to the restaurant and come home late at night after the restaurant was closed and was cleaned up and blah, blah, blah. So his father was not a guy who just ignored the kids. He couldn't
right.
He couldn't be there, and he wanted his son. Didn't he want Tom to go into the restaurant business?
He was, you know, there was this incomprehension of like, you know, he was in the same house as Tom, but I don't think he had any handle on like
right.
who his kid was. And so there's a point where he told him like, there's a Jack in the Box down the street. Like, you know, you could start working there, and like, you know, any knothead could be assistant manager in 6 months.
Right.
And Tom's like, well, thank you for the compliment, but also that's not what I want to do. And so,
When did he know what he wanted to do?
He didn't really know until he got to college. So he sort of like wandered through high school. He loved being in the drama club. I don't think he thought it was going to be something that happened in his life. And, you know, he applies to colleges. He's got, you know, sort of mediocre grades. So he goes to like a local community college, Shabbat. And then when he gets there, he runs into an old friend of his from high school. And the friend says, "Are you doing plays?" And Tom's like, "Oh, no, not really. I'm busy. I'm working as a bellhop at this Hilton." And his friend says, "Shame on you," which seems like ludicrously over the top. But at the same time, the friend was right. Like Tom Hanks was clearly a talented guy who needed to be doing shows. And so he gets into a college production of Our Town and falls in love with it all over again.
Right.
And then transfers down to a school in Sacramento where he can like study theater full time.
And he'd been cast and cast and cast because he has a likability factor to him, I'm sure. And he had talent. But there came a time when he wasn't cast.
Yes.
It was a shock to him.
Right.
He didn't get the lead.
He didn't get in a show at all. And so he went to found a different like community theater in Sacramento. And it turned out that the guy there who was directing the play also directed the festival, the Shakespeare Festival in Ohio, the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival. And said, hey, you know, I need interns. Mm-hmm. And that was really like the thing that got Tom started. That, you know, sort of, so he went out to Ohio, you know, to work for a pittance and to stay up till like sort of 3 a.m., like humping sets around and, you know, sort of like to look after the dog if there's like a dog on the play. But he also got to, you know, sort of like play some small parts in some Shakespeare plays. And, you know, like people start paying attention and he wins, you know, sort of like a local critics award. And he says, maybe I can make something of this.
But it wasn't all lead movies from the start. It took a long
time. Yes. Yep.
What kept him going? Because it took a long time. And I think, was he not married at the time when he first went to Hollywood and tried to make it?
He was married. Moved to New York with his girlfriend. Okay. And then they already had a kid. And then they got married in New York.
Okay. But it wasn't a bed of roses. It wasn't one play after the other and one Hollywood film after the other. In fact, it got to the point where...
Yeah.
He was not going to do it anymore, right?
Well, he just sort of, there was a certain amount of just like cussedness that he said he used to go into auditions and he's like, well, you know, sort of like, you know, I'm going to say I'm better than 50% of the people here, you know, like, and he would just like, he knew he had to tell himself this story. And then, you know, sort of maybe like the other people are going to be having an off day or whatever. So there's maybe like 5% of the people who might be auditioning. Maybe they won't show up today. I could get the part. And so, but even after he gets cast in Bosom Buddies, which is his big breakthrough,
right.
That, you know, sort of he's on a network sitcom, you know, sort of, and that's where I first saw him. Yeah. Like, and some, but show ends, you know, like.
It was a successful show.
It was a successful show, but there's no work after that.
Right.
You know, like he's got another couple of years where it's like, you know, once again, you're knocking on doors.
And you think that if you're on a sitcom, you're making a lot of money if you're on a sitcom.
Right.
You think that these guys, pie in the sky, have it made.
Yes.
He was driving an old beat up Volkswagen with the stuffing coming out of the seat. He was living in a nondescript house somewhere in the valley.
Yep.
So he wasn't. He wasn't living like a movie star or even a TV star, for that matter. And it's probably a good thing because, as you said, the show went off the air like, what?
Two seasons.
Yep. And it was, when it went off, it was a success.
Yeah, it was a moderate success. But, you know, sort of for people who don't remember the show, it was Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari
right. In
drag, sort of like because they got
some
a good
like it hot.
Yeah, it was Some Like It Hot. They got a good deal on a apartment in New York City if they could dress as women.
Right. Well, if they could be women.
Right. Sure. They were pretending. Well, they had to dress as women, right. So they could. People thought they were women in a women's only residency hotel.
So many years later, he's at a party. You write with Steve Martin happens to be there, and Steve mm-hmm. Martin sidles up to him and he says, "You've become a good actor. What did you do? Where did that come from?"
Yeah, and because, you know, Steve's somebody else who sort of, you know, like came out of just like being a comic and had to get better. And Tom says, basically, you've got to do the work ahead of time. And it's a sort of question that, and this is actually a good answer to your question of how do you find out these things? That, you know, he probably wouldn't answer that question for most people, but it's Steve Martin asking. So he's like, all right, I'm going to try to like give it a good shot.
Right.
And he says that basically you don't have to like necessarily like do like a dream journal of the character, but you have to put in the work so you know who the person was and when they're coming from.
Right.
And if you do that, then it informs what you do.
He could be one of the richest movie stars on the planet
yeah.
right now. And he is on his second long-term marriage with mm-hmm. Rita Wilson, who is also an actress and a writer, I think, and a producer.
He has a new album out.
Okay. And he has a child or a couple of children who are older who remember the poor Tom Hanks.
Two children from the first marriage, two from the second.
Okay. And the younger children mm-hmm. have lived in this overwhelmingly
right.
famous reality. But he tries to keep it as normal as he can. Of course, you have to have if you're that big, you have to have security.
Right. He says that's the biggest, most ostentatious thing about
it. Right. But he's trying to keep this normal. Mm-hmm. Is that really possible, do you think?
I think it's a version of normal. I talked with people who were friends of his from back in the Shakespeare Festival days who knew him when he was this, like right. the guy, you know, in like dirty jeans. But now, you know, sort of like they have a reunion. If they like go to like a restaurant, you know, sort of people are going to freak out if they see him. And so he finds ways to, like, disarm them. That, like, he'll walk right up to them and say, hey, I'm Tom Hanks. And then if they burst into tears as a result, well, you know, like, he can comfort them and make them feel better. But better that than just sort of, like, having people point across the room, hey, it's Tom Hanks, it's Tom Hanks. He tries to make it into a normal situation.
Well, this hour has flown. What's that music playing for? The world, according to Tom Hanks, the life, the obsessions, the good deeds of America's most decent guy. And it's also illustrated. It's rare that you see a biography that's illustrated.
With brilliant illustrations by Bob Sikoriak. He's a genius. I was so lucky to work with him.
Gavin Edwards, author, charlatan. Thanks so much for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.